May join as they have time.
Okay, well then let's go ahead and get started with the Des Moines Water Works Planning Committee meeting for Tuesday, May 4th. And we'll just start at the top of the agenda and ask folks to introduce themselves as they speak. And first up, we have the filter backwash tank rehabilitation.
Andrea, if I might, I'd take just 1 minute here to introduce the topic. Don Staley is an engineer in our engineering department, a project manager, in fact, in our engineering department here at Des Moines Water Works. The backwash tank is an integral part of our treatment process here at the Fuller Drive Treatment Plant, and it's been in a state of distress for some time, and so now we're actually going to move ahead and rehabilitate or replace the entire tank. So Don is going to walk us through a little bit of what that's about and what the project will involve. So Don, take it away.
All right. Let's see if I can share the screen here. Can everybody see that?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the filter backwash tank replacement project. On the agenda, I see that it's a rehabilitation, but as you will be able to see when we get a little bit farther into it, I think we're talking replacement for this component of the process. Here you have the Fluor Drive facility there, and in the yellow rectangle there is kind of the location of where our filtration process takes place. This is the filter in the chemical building that you see in the yellow rectangle there. There we go. Zooming in a little bit closer, the filter backwash tank is located in the chemical building. It's positioned high up and in an enclosure that's located to the west side of the tower that you see when you're down in the plant there of the chemical building. The primary portion of the building is located to the east there if you look up to it from the courtyard area there. I thought it'd be beneficial to talk a little bit about what the filtration process actually is and why the filter tank is important, or the backwash tank is very important to us. This is some diagrams of rapid sand filters, and this is the filtration process that we have at the Fluor Drive plant there. Basically, the one to the left, there is a schematic type view of the filter, and then I have a section shown on the other side there. But basically, if you can see my cursor there, how the process works is that the water is pumped on top of the filter media. It runs through kind of a fine sand type mix here, gets down through that, is collected up into kind of a gravel arrangement in the bottom there. And then it's collected up into a network of pipes where it's pumped out of the filter and taken to our storage area. Over time, as the filter runs, the filter gets loaded with sediment, and it's time to clean it, and that is the backwash process. It's actually cleaning the sediment that collects up into these rapid sand filters. This is a SCADA image of our filtration system that's at the Fluor Drive plant there. Kind of located in the center here, you see that that is the filter, kind of a diagram showing that. The key elements to that we're going to be talking about here is the filter backwash tank, which is this symbol that we have right in this location here. The filter backwash tank is supplemented by two backwash pumps that draw from the finished water and actually create additional flow that backs up through the filter and cleans that up, cleans the sediment out of the filter. We're going to go through a few slides. I got 9 slides here that just quickly go through what the process actually is when you're backwashing there. Another thing I like to point out when we're talking about backwash is that we have what's called the backwash recycle tank. And that's a big, in this case, it's shown as rectangular, but it's actually a round 100-foot diameter tank that's buried underground at the plant there. And when we backwash our water from the filters, that water is stored up into this backwash tank, and then that's reintroduced into the process. It's water that is a little farther along in the treatment process than the raw water. And so we have been for many years collecting up the backwash water. So you'll see that when I go through this, there's an awful lot of water that's used in the backwash process, but we do collect it and introduce it back into the process. This is a typical filter arrangement that we have. If you've been in the filter building, you've seen this, but basically this is a typical rapid sand filter, and our filters are set up with these concrete troughs that are located at the top there, and they're very important to the backwash process. So this is a filter as you would see it as it's operating and the water is going through it and being treated. This is the first part of the backwash process. The first step is to actually draw the water down through the filter. And you can see all that white sediment that on the top of that is kind of the remnant materials that are left over from our excess lime softening process. A lot of that material ends up being collected up on the filters there. And the first step is to draw it down below these concrete troughs that you see in the image there. The very first step that we do is something that's a little bit newer technology. I don't know really the period and everything when it was introduced, but there's bubbling air that is pushed back through the sand, and it kind of agitates it and loosens things up quite a bit in the process. And it preserves water, and it also does a better job of kind of agitating everything and allowing things to be cleaned up. That process is called air scouring. And so this kind of rough type looking surface that you have there is actually air bubbles that are being pushed up through the filter media there and kind of shaking up the sediment that's collected on the filter there. This is a little better view of the scour process with the actual media all drained, or the actual water all drained down into the process. You can see these troughs here are very integral to the backwash process, but that's the next slide. You'll kind of see what that's doing. But in this kind of roughened area here and everything, we're shaking up all the sediment that's collected on the filter and getting it ready to be washed out of the filter. As the water is introduced backwards through the system, it's introduced at a higher rate than it is filtered through the filter. And when you accelerate that water going backwards through the media, it actually lifts it up and kind of suspends it in the water, much like if you saw it like in a beach or something like that, where the waves are coming in and moving the sand. Same kind of process happens here. It's kind of a tweaking operation that they use, because if you lift it too much, you can see that it would cascade over the top of these troughs and get carried away. But if you don't lift it enough, you don't get enough scour onto your media there to clean it up real good. So it's a very interesting process. This is where the backwash process initially starts. And you can see now that the water has raised up high enough that it cascades over the top of the concrete troughs there. And it starts filling into that center trough where the water is drained away and sent to the backwash recycle tank. This is another view of the same process, only a little farther along. You can see that we have a real milky, really highly turbid water there that is being lifted up and drawn out of the filters there. And after a period of time, I don't have a real good feel, maybe Ted would know on that, but eventually all that milky kind of sediment and everything is washed out and cleaned up pretty good. And you get a fairly clear water here that's got just a little bit of cloudiness in it. And this is the final stage of the backwash process. And then everything is allowed to kind of sit still for a little while. The sand is allowed to kind of settle back down in and reposition itself. And the filter is ready to go back into service when it looks like this. And this is a this is the final part. This is what it looks like when it's all settled out and ready to go back online. Okay, I'm going to present a little bit here. This is an of what the building looks like and where the filter backwash tank is positioned. What this is a section of the chemical and a little portion of the filter building from the 1945 plans when the building was constructed. The filter backwash tank is located up in this area that I've kind of highlighted here in red, kind of a red rectangle there. And I have traced out the actual physical size of the tank itself. So you can kind of imagine when you look at that building, that's a pretty good sized building we have down there. And the filter backwash tank takes up a huge portion of it. It's all one big cylinder that's loaded up and rest on this platform here that's constructed out of structural steel. The area that you kind of see to the left-hand side there, if you've been in the filter gallery there, that's the kind of ornate area that has all the white terracotta and the arches and that sort of thing to give you a perspective where this is located relative to the rest of the facility there. The backwash tank is located above the lobby as you come into the filter building there. And one of the consequences that we've had over the years is that the backwash tank has corroded, it started leaking, and it's done a tremendous amount of damage to that lobby. As you can see, it's positioned right above that that area. We have kind of patched it up in the 90s. The filter backwash top tank was accelerating in its leaking. What we used to do is we used to go into the tank and kind of weld steel patches on it and patch it up. And that got so it was almost a weekly task. And so the first step that we did is kind of put a submarine type door on it. And that was a little chore that I did back in the 90s. And so that the welder could go in there routinely a lot easier instead of having to climb over the top. And then eventual leaking was just so uncontrollable that we actually put a the equivalent of like a pool liner in it. And that hit was a very successful kind of stopgap measure that we did in the 90s. But that's pretty much not stopped all the problems that we've had with the backwash tank, but it slowed things down. And we bought about 30 years of borrowed time on that. What I have here, what I'm showing here, and this is always an interesting thing, probably to more to engineers than anyone else, but this is what's called the shop drawing of the original tank. And you can see at the lower level there where we have this circle there, that is the bottom of the tank. And the tank is just a series of steel plates that are all kind of overlapped on top of each other and all welded together there. As the tank started deteriorating, we were getting leaking between these plates, and we were and sheets of water would be just cascading through the building. It was really quite a problem until we got the liner on there. This image right up here is the backwash tank sides, and those are curved plates of steel that are all welded together to kind of make this big tin can that is essentially almost 35 feet tall and about 26 feet in diameter. This gives you a little picture of what the tank looks like. It was hard for me to get any pictures to actually see what the tank is because it's so huge, but you can kind of see from the top here, this is the top of the tank on the left-hand side. You can kind of see the ceiling there. And one of the formidable problems that we had in considering what to do with this is that the ceiling that's above the filter there is constructed out of a reinforced concrete deck. And that is a very stout structure, something that we really didn't want to have to tear out if we could avoid it. So in the research that I did, I found that it was possible to actually get a tank that you can buy in segments and you can actually bolt it together in place. That is the process that we got before us. The picture to the right there is kind of the bottom of the tank, and you can kind of see that it passes through floor levels for several stories there. Also good to kind of note the corroded surface here. It looks a lot better from this distance. One of the things that I have been in the tank for, or I've been underneath the tank several times, and this is photographs from when I was underneath the tank in the last time. And this now is almost 10 years ago now. But there's been so much leakage that has happened on the tank that the structural steel that is supporting it is starting to corrode. And some of it is corroding to extensive levels. Others portions of it are like in the upper right hand or upper left hand corner here, still have some of the original paint, but have some corrosion developing and that sort of thing. The image on the upper left and the center upper is the structural steel. In the center bottom is probably one of the worst locations of the structural steel. You can see right in this area right here, if you can see my cursor there, that the steel is starting to kind of separate a little bit. And this is the big warning sign that you, as a structural engineer, that when your steel starts doing that, it starts losing its strength at kind of an accelerated level. These are some close-up views here on the upper right and the lower left. Those are close-up images of the tank itself. And you can see how deeply pitted it is in many locations there. We're down to a very, very thin margin between the inside of the tank and the outside of the tank. If the tank had not had its liner in it, it probably would be leaking at this point because these pits are deep enough. Some of them go all the way through the tank. The replacement process, as it's planned right now, will take place going through the windows that are located on the front side of the chemical building. And this is kind of just a Google Earth image of that. And we're going to buy the tank such that we can get the segments actually pushed in through the window. To get the tank out, we'll be cutting it up into pieces and bringing it out through the window. So the entire operation will happen through the window. When we get the tank, what I'm proposing is to get a galvanized tank so that we won't have the pitting process. The tank that we have now is just plain steel. Get a galvanized tank similar to this one that's in this image right here. And it is put together as a series of segments that are bolted together on the outside of the tank there. So you can see all these lines that are on the outside of the tank are little flanges that have several bolts in them. And basically what we'll be doing is bringing in the segments of this tank into the inside and assembling it in the building in the interior. Now, these kind of tanks, they're primarily used in the petrochemical industry. There are a few of them that are used in water production type stuff, but this technology is something that is far more common when you are containing chemicals and that sort of thing. It is a watertight system. It is, they typically put gaskets in between the bolted areas there. And then when you bolt them down, it kind of crimps it together. And that is a waterproof system. We're not going to depend on that. We had such luck with the liner. We're going to start the life of the project with a new liner. And this is an image from one of the companies that makes tank liners. And it'll look very much like this. The outside of the tank will be a bolted steel system. The inside will have a liner similar to the one that we have in there right now. We know we got 30 years out of the one liner that we had, and it is still doing just fine. And so we thought we'd start the new tank with a liner and give it a chance. The previous one made it 60 some years, a backwash tank. We think we can do a lot better with the new system. And that is all I have for you folks.
So a creative solution to replace a piece of equipment that was essentially original to the facility. Any questions for Don before we move on to another quick update?
Yeah, I have some questions like, when will it start? How long will it take? And how much will it cost? And the final one, is there any salvage value to what's in there now?
Well, there is some salvage value, but not much. Basically, just the tonnage of scrap steel.
Yeah.
A lot of times what you do with that is you make it you give it to the contractor, and that offsets a little bit of your cost and everything. So we usually pick up the salvage costs by giving it to the contractor. And sometimes those guys are real creative and have another use for those kind of things. The budget number, are you on top of that, Ted? It always gets asked, and we're technical guys, and so we're all worried about getting the flanges right and all that stuff.
Who cares how much it costs?
You don't care about that. We figure you'll come up with the money, Diane. So,
I'll comment on that. The budget's a little over $400,000 presently.
Okay. I'll throw an additional question in with the budget question. Is this replacement now in the capital improvements plan, or is this kind of an emergency thing?
This is capital improvements. We've been tracking it for a while. This is kind of my baby, and I'm excited to finally get to do it. Cause it's been one of those things that's been rusting, and we've had a lot of leaks and a lot of deterioration in that space.
And Don, the timeline, it's in the budget to design and bid award this year, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And the actual construction timeline is obviously, we're going to want to do this at a time of year when demand is not high. So it'll be fall, winter sort of construction.
Yep. It'll be when the demand is low. Another benefit of that is the contractors for inside work in the winter, especially steel workers, are the kind of people that'll be doing this. It's a great project for them. So the stars are kind of aligning as far as our demand is low, and the contract price should be pretty good on it. So we'll be kicking it out toward the end of the year.
Will we make it until the end of the year?
I've been looking at that. Every time I look at it, I get more nervous. I went to take these pictures, you know, but there's a lot of mitigating factors on that, that the plates overlap, and basically where those scary pictures are, they're overlapped areas. So there's two layers there, but I'm glad we're doing it this year. I'm glad we're doing it.
I have a question that's really tangential, so humor me, I suppose, kind of from my own curiosity that emerges from my previous work on the Historic Preservation Commission, especially when you started talking about going in and out through the window, and you know, windows are often kind of the key aspects of historic buildings. Does that building have any historic designation or any restrictions on it like that?
I'm not sure, but those windows have been replaced in the 90s.
Sure.
But we did a really nice job of making them look historic, didn't we? They're yeah,
they look like it.
They're very expensive windows. Those are Hope windows, and they're actually a steel window where the individual panes in there, it's a thermal pane, but they're actually made like the old-fashioned grid windows that we still have in the pump station there. The only difference is they haven't got that putty and everything that falls out of them. But they are a nice steel window there. That was part of, I was here in 93, in the flood of 93, backwash tank was damaged heavily, and we got a really good settlement on it. And we had a lot of money left over, and we spent the money on the windows. We had a lot of money left over from the built backwash tank. It was estimated to repair it at $2 million, and I was able to fix it for $100,000. And so we had 1.9 million to do all kinds of nice things in the plant there. And the windows were one of them. I remember those as being about $50,000 a piece back then. And that was at that time, that wasn't much more than my house cost. So that's just a little bit of history on that.
Thank you.
So you have to take floor down while you do this? Does floor have to be taken down completely?
No, Diane, we will. We're looking into an option for backwashing the filters without the tank. One of the drawings Don showed you had some backwash pumps that are typically used to supplement the backwash process, and we're looking at how we can backwash with just the pumps. That's a little more technical of operation. We'll have to figure out and make sure we can do that, but we won't be able to take fluor down, so we're going to have some other option. Well, there aren't any other questions. I would like to move on because we do have one other item I'd like to share with the planning committee today, and that is an update on our InfraMap software. And I just want to preface this by saying that it was 30 years ago plus when Des Moines Waterworks moved from paper record keeping to computer record keeping for our distribution system. We've even had new generations of GIS software come on board since then, but just until the last year or so, we've been doing a lot of our maintenance and tracking our maintenance of the distribution system, specifically related to hydrants and valves, in paper. And so InfraMap is a software that has allowed us to make the leap from paper to computer managed software maintenance on the valve and hydrant side. Don West, who is a supervisor in our water distribution department, and Brian Welker, who is a crew leader and uses this software every day, are gonna walk us through a little bit of that and give us an update. Gentlemen.
Thanks, Ted. Let me get the screen up here. Can everybody see that all right?
I can see it.
So the InfraMaps system, as Ted was saying, has been a better system for us to keep track of all the things that we do over here in the distribution department. If I can get my mouse over. So this is kind of an idea of what our maintenance schedule is like for the hydrants. As you'll see up at the top, that's Windsor Heights. Windsor Heights takes us 3 years to get through that. One that's not showing on here is Des Moines. Des Moines takes us 6 years to get all the hydrants maintained. So every 6 years, then we start back over again. So that's just kind of an idea of what we have to keep records of. The valves are the same way. So as you'll see here, this is our old ways of doing things. On the left-hand side, you'll see that's our winter hydrant walking. What the guys would do is they would take a section of the map and go out and follow the streets. And when they got one done, then they would mark it off. Or if there was water in it or needed something else, they would circle it and write a work order at the end of the day. As you can see, that's just a mess. That was our record keeping. We'd have to keep all those papers showing that they were walked. Some guys would lose them. We'd have to reprint them. You'd go on a main break and somebody would have to go do it, and there'd be one hydrant there, one hydrant here, you know. It just wasn't useful.
On the right-hand side is our books for hydrant maintenance and valve maintenance. And every valve and every hydrant in our system has a asset number assigned to it. And usually the books were basically in order of the asset number. And it wasn't always the most efficient system. Sometimes assets were assigned on a east-west grid, and you might be going on a north-south road. And so the hydrants wouldn't line up, or the valves wouldn't line up by asset number. After I first started here one day, we were doing some maintenance on Southwest 56th Street, and the asset numbers weren't lining up in the book. And so it was a long street, and I suppose there was probably I suppose there was probably 15 or so hydrants on that street, and we just, you know, zipped down them and got them all maintained. And being a new guy, I didn't know the process of filling out the paperwork. So the installer that was assigned with me, he spent probably about 15 minutes of the day just flipping through the book, trying to find all the hydrants that we had done. And then in some cases on valve maintenance, like in Pleasant Hill, you might do a valve over in Copper Creek, and then you have to run over on the east side to do the next valve in sequence. And so this system really helps us out. Everything comes up on a map, and you can just zip up and down streets very easily and check off your valves pretty easily just that way.
So here's the system. Some of the key features that this has, this does have GPS in it. So as Brian was talking about how the books would be here or there, because sometimes, like if you were at Bell and Fluor, one valve would show Bell, be at the top of the list, and the other one would start at Fluor, and they'd be right next to each other. So with that GPS, we can pull up where you're at, see all the valves and all the hydrants that may need maintained in that area. Because we also have people that are going to do main cuts, like in Windsor Heights, and they may have had the Pleasant Hill book. Well, all that time they're going to spend going to cut a main in Windsor Heights, driving to Pleasant Hill to go do some maintenance, and coming back to Windsor Heights was just a waste. So now they can just pull up the area that they're in and work in that area. It also has different layers, so we can keep everything that we have in this one system. Here's a showing our different layers that we have. So our hydrant head exchange, dead end flushing, maintenance, valve exercising, hydrant winter walking. That was all the papers that we were showing before. This was our first year using it for winter hydrant walking. So we found out it's better record keeping, but not as user friendly. Luckily, Adam, who is the rep for this, has been working with me. So by next year, we should have it so it's as user friendly as it is great for record keeping.
This is a layer for our hydrants, and each hydrant is assigned a color, whether it be a private hydrant or a public hydrant, and that is all on this layer. And each hydrant usually starts off with red, meaning it needs maintained. And so then you would click on the hydrant, and it brings up a page. So you click on a valve or hydrant. This would be a valve here, and it basically brings up all the information that GIS provides us with measurements and the types of valve it is, the direction it opens, how many turns. And on the left-hand side there, you'll see a time and date. That is a service record. So if you wanted to see who serviced that hydrant or valve last, you could click on that record and it would populate up, and it would tell you who serviced it, what they did to it, how many turns they got to it, and all the information that you would need on it. So it's good for record keeping, like Don said, and it really helps out. It'll tell you exactly the last time it was maintenance. And so if someone would come through and do maintenance on a valve, and a year later they come through and did a main cut on that same valve, they could update it so that the timer on it would set. Every valve, every hydrant has a timer set with the schedule that it needs to be maintenance. So if we're running a valve a year after it was maintenance, that timer gets reset by doing this. Here's an example of when you click on that valve or hydrant. This would be a valve. That's the example of what you do on it. So you have your turns, the staff member that ran the valve or hydrant, and what status it's in. So you can put it in open status or closed status if it's closed. If you're on an extended main cat, you could say it's closed and someone could get on that valve, click on it, and it would say, oh, this is closed already. You could also put any comments, whether, you know, if it runs hard or it was broke, say you broke it during maintenance or during a main cat, and you could put down the work order. You can put your EAM work order of that valve needing replaced or hydrant needing replaced in this section also.
This is just basically the same information, but on the hydrant side. So it gives you an idea of what we're looking at on the hydrant side. Once again, it shows you different colors on what needs maintained, when it needs maintained. On this screen, you'll see for the hydrants. So everything that they do is checkmarked. So you can go over here and see if, because sometimes in the winter time, we don't get a float as hard, or we don't get a float at all because due to the temperature. So we have just do a pressure test, make sure it's not leaking or anything. So we would be able to see when they did it, if it was winter time, if they floated or not. So it gives us great options for that. You get to see who was there if you have any questions to ask them. Once again, same thing. All the information that we have on our GIS program is transferred over into this program. Another nice option for this is I get to run reports off of it. It keeps track of everything. I can see which employees did what where, what valves still need done, which ones are incomplete. It's something that we've been having little problems with because at first they had a number that was assigned to it. I couldn't run reports over, I think, 100. Well, in Des Moines, we have well over 100 hydrants. So whenever I'd pull that up, but we've got that fixed and I'm able to transfer that into an Excel spreadsheet. So I can break it down from there on any information that I want to be in there. And this is just an example. So right there, I'm in incompleted valves in Pleasant Hill, click that up and it brings that up. So that goes off of our programs that we have set with timers. If I wanted to look at a specific time, like how many valves did we do between January and February of last year, it allows me to do that as well. And it'll show me which ones were done. So overall, the program's going to be a lot better than we had in the past. It's a huge record keeping ordeal that we have instead of just keeping papers everywhere. We're still figuring out little things. Like I said, the winter hydrant walking, it was our first year doing it. We didn't know what to expect. Thought it'd be a little bit easier, but honestly, just highlighting something on a piece of paper is quicker than clicking around on a computer. So Adam's working with me where we're going to figure out a way, and I'm pretty sure we'll have a way that it's going to be easier for next year and quicker for the guys. So that would be it. Does anybody have any questions?
No questions. Well, I think you can see the significant advancement from the cut up sheets of paper laying on the table to real time data in every vehicle. A little hard to imagine that we're in 2021 and just able to implement that, but it's tremendous enhancement. And thank you to these gentlemen for presenting and for putting the time in it took to get the system set up. So nice work and thank you.
Yes, thank you guys for sharing that. It seems like a sanity saver as well as a time saver. Well, if nobody else has any other questions on that topic, then we'll turn it to Ted. If you have any CEO or general manager comments that you want to share at this time, or
just one, Andrea, I just want to mention to the board that we're really starting to see the impacts of the dry conditions this summer, this spring already. Typical river flows in the Raccoon River for this day of the year are about 4,000 CFS. That would be normal. The mean flow in the river, right now the river's at 300 CFS. So instead of the normal springtime 4,000, we're at 300. We're starting to see gallery production decline, well production decline just about the same time that we're expecting demand to go up. So the drought is real. We need some rain. If we don't get it, this could be a challenging time. But Nothing more than that, Andrea, today, just awareness.
Okay. Did we get any rain over the weekend, Ted? I thought it looked like Northwest Iowa got some.
You know, here, as you know, we just got tents. We didn't get enough to raise river levels, at least nothing that we've seen yet. Diane, the river levels have stayed pretty consistent here this week, about 300 CFS on the raccoon.
Well, keep our fingers crossed for some rain in the next few weeks, lots of rain in the next few weeks.
Ted, perhaps maybe this is related. I suspect it might be somewhat related, at least. Can you talk to us about the story in Axios Des Moines this morning about the taste of the water? I thought your comments were good, pretty troubling headline. The meat of the story wasn't so bad, but I thought it was unfortunate that was kind of, you know, what people are reading about waterworks today. So I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Joel, sorry. We did have a few calls last week. People were noticing an off taste in the water and they were wondering why. We got a couple of media inquiries about, was there a taste problem in the water? Was there an issue? Were we getting calls? And the answer is yes, we did get a few calls, a number of calls, in fact. And there's always a question when we get taste and odor calls about, well, is that an indication of concern, or is there a water safety question to be answered there? You know, my explanation of taste and odor is kind of this art and science piece. You know, there's science to water treatment. We all know that if we run the water through a specific process and we measure the right parameters and we hit the right targets, we get the pH to the right level, we introduce the right amount of chlorine for the right amount of time, we know the water's safe. That's the science. pH, chlorine, they kill the things, they remove the contaminants. We know that the water's safe. So that's not in question. Those are also things that we can monitor on a real-time, continuous basis. pH, chlorine residual, all of those things are monitored real-time. They're in our permit, and they're part of the drinking water regulations, if you will. So that was never in question. There were never any issues. Taste and odor is more an art, okay? There are a lot of things in the river that can impart a taste or an odor, and there are also a lot of people who are very sensitive to subtle changes in taste or odor in the water. We do monitor for taste and odor every day, but we monitor for it by literally tasting the water and smelling the water. There's no instrumentation that can monitor for taste or odor. It's a human being in the lab or in the control center tasting the water and smelling the water and making process decisions based on that actual taste and odor. And there's a little bit of an art there in determining, you know, what it is that's causing a taste or an odor, what to do about it to ensure that the taste and odor of the water stays consistent and basically not detectable. We did detect a bit of an off taste in the water early last week. Adjustments were made in the process. I think we addressed it pretty quickly, but not until some amount of that water with a little bit of an off taste made it out into the system. And then the challenge is that even a small amount of that water kind of takes time to find its way through the distribution system. You know, some people don't receive water until a week or more after it leaves the plant. So there's an art and science there. It is something we might manage every day. We test every day, we treat for every day. It's not a question of water safety. It's an aesthetic question, but we did have a little bit of an off taste for a short period of time last week.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Spinning off of that, we'll take a moment to see if there's any if there are any members from the public that have any comments. I don't see any new names, but Michelle, do you know?
I agree. No general public on that I can tell.
Well, with that, we'll go ahead and close the planning meeting and turn it over to the community relations folks.